We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at Uni Church on the campus of UNSW, which was attended primarily by undergraduate and postgraduate students who lived on campus or in the suburbs surrounding the university.
What I've got so far in the talks that I've gone through in my notes anyway, is the outline of the Bible. Let me just recap so you know where we're up to, and don't know what your headings look like, but mine now run over several pages. I started off with how does God guide, and I say through the Bible. Then I pointed out that the world has lots of confusing issues on the subject of sex, and then talked then about what the Bible says. And I painted the background with a huge overview of what the whole Bible's teaching is about by looking at those great purple passages like Romans 8 and Ephesians 1. And then I said, now what we're going to look at is just one subject in detail. It's not even the central subject of the cross of Jesus. It's just a detail down the bottom left-hand corner of the picture. That is, where does sex, what part does sex play in this grand scheme? We then looked at sex in creation and in the fall, and then looked at what the old covenant makes of it, and now what the new covenant makes of it. There's the structure of the talk. If you had your outline, that would be printed out in front of you. You haven't got one, for various reasons. I'm learning bad habits from my brother. Now, how does God guide me? Well, by what the Bible teaches. That's how he guides me. Does God's guidance tell me whether I should marry Drusilla? Or, no, I've got, there's someone in the church with that other name, so I've got a new name. Dorinda. I know a girl called Dorinda. Does exist as a name. As one person only. Now, which one should I marry? Well, the framework of what you've already been told gives certain answers. Firstly, should I marry? Is the first question to ask. Don't just assume that I should. Should I marry? It's an irrelevance to my godliness, unless, of course, I'm doing it out of an anti-asceticism or an anti-hedonism or something like that. It's irrelevant, really. It's a good thing to marry, but it may be a better thing for the cause of the gospel if I don't. Have I got the gift to remain single? Or haven't I got that gift? Should I take the gift of being married? My experience of life is that nearly everybody has the gift of marriage. Very, very few people have the gift of being single. Those who do should be encouraged to use that gift to further the work of the gospel. Those who don't should not be encouraged to live what is unrealistic in their lifestyle. That's all very simple. But if I haven't got the gift of being single, I've got only the gift of being married, or I have the gift of being married, how do I go about getting married? And Paul says, tell the younger widows to marry again. Well, I know many a younger widow who'd be only too happy to oblige, but how do you go about doing it if you're a younger widow? What do? Ring up Perfect Match or something like that? Get yourself lined up? I mean, how does the Christian set out to find a partner like that, especially the younger widow, the single girl? Should I marry? If I answer, no, I shouldn't marry, and some of you may well be answering that question at the moment, then there are, sorry, if it's going to be no, I'm not going to marry, there can be a couple of different reasons. One is that I am not free to marry. I'm not free because I'm already married. That's a reason, isn't it? And separated from my partner. So he says, should I marry? The answer is no. I should return to my partner. You say, well, no, I shouldn't at this stage because no one's asked me. Is it necessary for the proposal to come from the man? Doesn't seem the Bible teaches that. Though it does see that man takes leadership. And that may be part of it. But I don't think that it's necessary. You do need to remember, though, that God works in everything for good. And you need to concentrate on his work rather than the advantages of being single, and seek contentment rather than spend all your time dissatisfied with your present lot. If you are at this moment single, don't spend the whole of your waking hours worrying about it, complaining about it, trying to change your state. It is too unimportant an issue for that. Seek to take the advantage of being single and use it. There are great advantages. You can have Bible studies without creche organisations, for example. It is much easier to do a whole range of things in Christian work, beach missions, and all kinds of things you can do when you're single, which you'll not be able to do later on. Take advantage of being single as long as you are. Don't complain. Look to the advantages. It's a funny thing, really. When you're single, you think that you'll solve your problems by getting married. And when you're married, you think you'd solve your problems by being single. It's got to do with the grass being greener. One of my dear friends who's been around our church for a long time, and who I can tell this story accurately without mentioning the name, said one night that when she got engaged, everybody congratulated her, said how wonderful it was, how marvellous it was. And when she got married and she mentioned to a couple of friends that she was having problems, they said, yeah, it's always like that. But she said, no one told me before I was married. They all told me it was wonderful. And then when I was pregnant, they all said, it's fantastic, isn't that marvellous news? And when the baby came and had teething problems and wind problems, a few other ones said, oh, it's always like that. Now, we do have this kind of unrealistic, idealistic expectation as to what marriage will do. All you do when you get married is you change your problems. You move from one set of problems to another set of problems. That's all you do. You don't solve any problems as such. So it's important to grasp hold of that, because you can say, well, look, if I was just married. No. Get on with being single and enjoy, learn contentment, enjoy the advantages it gives you, and trust in God that he will provide for you, and indeed pray for him. Pray for the partner that you need. Tell him of your needs. Look for a partner by all means. But don't make that the chief end of life. Those, of course, who choose, though, to remain single, those who choose to remain single, need to set up a lifestyle that will cope with it, because by and large society can't cope with those who choose to stay single. Society builds itself on families. Now, those of us who are married, we've got to be very kind to those who remain single, by their choice or not their choice. We've got to be kind to them, to include them, to provide for them. At the moment, that's no hassle here. 5 years' time, you mob, most of you, be married. Oh, incredible thought, isn't it? Yeah. I had a look at the picture today. Steve Gooch has brought along at the 1976 mid-year conference crowd. There are only a couple married there. There are 22 people in the picture. I counted up 25 kids that they have between them. Their marriage sets in very quickly after university. Within 10 years, there'll be more children of this group of people here tonight than there are these people here tonight. It's astonishing, isn't it? Well, I mean, that's obviously what's about to hit you, isn't it? And yet some of us won't get involved in that process. And we as a group, as a community, as people, must always care for those who don't get involved in that process, especially those who choose not to for the sake of the gospel, and those who, for other reasons, do not get married. If we're not married at this stage, then what sexual activity should we engage in? The answer seems to me to be very simple. With other people, absolutely none. Seems to me the simple answer of the Bible. For the Bible speaks against fornication and against adultery. It perceives sexuality as a bonding process of fellowship and as a way of reproduction. And it is very concerned that we as Christians do not get caught in sexual immorality, but we flee sexual immorality. I think it seems absolutely clear from the Bible that sexual activity before marriage, outside marriage, is wrong. Perfectly clear. Now comes the Pharisees' question. How far do we go? Does this mean we are not to look at each other? Not to wink at each other? Not to look long and meaningfully at each other? Not to sit close to each other? Not to hold hands? Not to... What are those two fellows doing, eh? Not to... How far down the track of physical contact do we go before we say, ah, that's it, there's the line? See, now that's the Pharisee's question, isn't it? Because why does the Pharisee ask that question? Because he wants to see how far he can go before he's forbidden. He's not concerned fundamentally to be one who is pure and holy. He is concerned fundamentally with getting away with as much as he can. Now, that's your orientation. If you want to be able to do as much as you can without breaking the rules, then you are, in fact, of course, someone who is a lawbreaker in your heart. It's exactly what Jesus is speaking against when he talks about lusting in your heart, having committed adultery already. You obey the law, but not from your heart. You obey it begrudgingly, wishing to find loopholes, wishing to find ways. That's what the whole taxation dodge system is about, isn't it? People who try and dodge tax are people who don't want to pay tax. If you want to pay the tax, then you don't employ an accountant to find ways of avoiding tax, do you? You don't set up tax avoidance schemes. If you want to live in holiness and righteousness, you don't start off by saying, well, how far can I go? The very question says, you don't want to live in holiness and righteousness. So, well, that's, okay, Philip, I get the point. But how far can I go? No far. That's how far. Very simple, isn't it? He said, oh, it can't be right. I said, why can't it be right? He said, well, I've got to have some experience before marriage. Why? You've got a whole lifetime of experience ahead of you. Yeah, but what happens if it's not going to work? Don't worry about that. Only the modern man has ever worried over such a thought, such an idea. God's been in the business of making bodies for centuries. By and large, they all work. You don't have to sit to and worry about and try it out beforehand. It's not like buying a motor car in terms of, you know, just take a spin around the block to see if the gears don't crash or something. I mean, it's not like that. You don't need, in fact, where you do have difficulties, nearly all the difficulties lie in the heart and the mind, not in the bodies. And so what you do in terms of a relationship with each other is more likely to do damage. It's more likely to do damage than make things better. The regrets that are caused by one partner pushing, one partner psychologically manipulating, one partner making sure their needs are being satisfied when the other partner doesn't want it, that's more likely to do damage to the relationship down the track than to help the relationship physically. How far do you go? No far. You say, but does that mean we live like little islands, never so much as even touching each other? I say, well, it's like what I was doing with the Pharisee question earlier. There's touching and there's touching, isn't there? There is touching and there is, here's my chance, you see, the thin edge of the wedge, I can... Look what Paul says in Timothy there. He tells Timothy, treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters with absolute purity. I don't have any sisters. I only got brothers. I know how to treat them. You bash them up whenever you give them an opportunity. Too true. Yeah. As soon as I got big enough to bash my two big brothers up, they left home. How do you treat younger women as sisters? It's very clear, isn't it? You don't have to have sisters to know what's there. It doesn't mean that you don't necessarily touch them, but it does mean you never touch them erotically. Doesn't it? You don't touch them in that romantic sense. Well, that's stimulating sense. That is not what you do. You do nothing that is directed towards sexual arousal. Because that is inappropriate, isn't it? That doesn't mean you don't help them down the steps. That doesn't mean that you don't necessarily go shopping walking hand in hand or arm in arm, because you're not really walking there in that context in sexual arousal and stimulation. That's not what you're trying to do, is it? I mean, when my mother-in-law gives me one of her kisses, it's got nothing to do with sexual arousal. As cold and as wet, as they say, a mother-in-law's kiss. I've got a lovely mother-in-law. Say that, she might listen to the tape. Not true. She's got a sense of humour. Me too, she's got... I'm not talking about physical contact under any circumstances at any time. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, what is the purpose of it at this point? If it has got to do with sexual arousal, it is irrelevant to you outside of marriage. It is inappropriate to you outside of marriage. Several of the questions rightly pick the question, this bonding idea, and they say, well, when does bonding start? Does it only start with sexual intercourse? And of course the answer is no, it doesn't. It starts with sexual arousal, which happens a long time before the actual bonding process, before intercourse. Long time before it. So people can say, well, look, we've never actually slept together. Well, we have slept together. We've never had intercourse together. I mean, we've been sleeping together on and off for years, but never really just had intercourse, so therefore we're right. We haven't fornicated, as the Bible says. But see, the character of that relationship has gone way in excess of their commitment to each other in marriage. Very dangerous pattern and behaviour, because they will, just through that process, be working at bonding. And working, making decisions will be very difficult from there on in. It's inappropriate. So, what are we doing in our dating practices? Now, at this point, I'm moving a fair way from the scriptures. And I cannot make great prescriptions. But I can ask the right question, I think. Is the practice that you are engaged in one of initiating sexual arousal? Because if so, it's an inappropriate way of going out. If it is one which is aimed at getting to know the other person better and developing a relationship with them, then it'd be a very helpful thing to do. But so much of the getting dressed up, the going off to romantic situations, and then parking in the car in a shady street afterwards, has all got to do with sexual foreplay. Has got to do with sexual arousal. And has got absolutely nothing to do with finding whether the partner is suitable or not. Or developing a relationship upon which you could build a marriage later. Or learning how to relate yourself in an ongoing commitment of relationship with a partner. It doesn't help any of those things. All it does is it bonds you together emotionally, physically, psychologically. So that you wind up wanting to marry someone because you're so far down the track emotionally in commitment to them that you can't see the fact that the marriage is bound to be a disaster. Can't see the wood for the trees anymore because you're just so caught up in it. You've already run ahead of the commitment. And so you wind up marrying like the pagans do, out of the lust of the flesh, and suffer the consequences. Marry in haste and repent in leisure. To which my wife always adds that that kind of repentance would never be leisurely. Murder. But there's the option. What if you're married already? Well, I think at that point we'll call up a halt and pick up with those things tomorrow and go to these questions. Is that all right? I think now I've given you enough of an outline of ideas and approaches for us to answer most of these kinds of questions with relative speed. I think there's about 30 questions, so if I spend more than a minute or two on any one of them, we're done for, aren't we? So there's got to be snappy answers, like Snappy Tom, and But at the same time, some of the questions are very good and worthwhile and valuable, and we really could spend some time trying to work out longer and more detailed answers. I hope that everything else that's been said, they will make the quick answers understandable to you. If not, we'll still go for hands up further discussion either tonight or tomorrow. In what practical ways can a Christian couple going out together prevent the physical side of their relationship from going too far? Excellent question. You really do need to think. It's nice to think of it positive. You see, you want to control. Well, one, never be in the... See, here are control factors outside. Right? The problem really is in with your own heart. But there are circumstances that can make things easier or harder. Don't be in the same room or house as each other unaccompanied. That's one of the old golden rules, which is very helpful. I mean, two people get together in a house or in one of the college rooms where there's only one piece of furniture you can actually do anything with, and that's a bed. Right? And it is dreadful. The chairlessness of the college rooms makes it almost impossible. Right, for you. So one of you warm soon on the bed, and then, well, it's hopeless, you see. Don't go there alone. If you have to be in a place, you leave the door wide open. But do your relationship building out in public. You can do it out in public in lots of ways, apart from just walking around the university, which are one of the helpful ways I have of talking to people privately about matters. Another is to sit in crowded places. Crowded places are a marvellous way of being anonymous, you know. To get out, to be seen and to be visible is a great protection for you. Sitting in the motor car is a disaster area. Don't talk in the motor car. Park and get out. Use the motor car for transport. That's what it's basically arranged for, I understand. Get out of the motor car. Try and devise those kinds of relational activities which are not going to put you into the context and the stimulation of physical sexual contact. That's not helpful. Not helpful building a relationship. But go to those kinds of activities which will help you develop your relationship with each other. In my days, it was stupid. We spent so much of our time going to picture shows. Hardly ever learnt what your partner was like by sitting in a picture show with them. Huh? You learnt what a picture show was about, and then you never talked with each other. It just wasn't a very thought out approach. It was just the norm everyone went. Well, fortunately, picture theatres have all closed down, thanks to television and other things. But you do need to think about the circumstances and situations you find yourself in and avoid those ones that give you any problems and be radical in the surgery of that area. And to find the advantage of actually mixing with friends. You see, as I watch my partner relate to other people, I learn a lot about my partner. There are times when you need, and it's very important for your relationship, to develop just the two of you talking with each other, sharing with each other, thinking about life with each other. But it's also important to see how each other relates to other people too. And visiting each other's homes and meeting each other's parents and brothers and all the rest of it. It's all a very important process in learning to evaluate, learning to relate, learning to know and love and care for the other person. It doesn't all have to be in the romantic context. The romantic ones are fairly dangerous. How do you decide the physical limits of a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship? Well, I think I've given you that, haven't I? That is very simple. None. None limits? No. None physical. Philip, I have a friend who used to get attached to his girlfriends, and yet he never had sex with them, though he will admit to a little kissing and cuddling now and then. Is our view of sex too narrow and legalistic by saying that they are not having sex, or is cuddling and kissing part of sex, or causing bonding between people, etc.? So that's the point, Ben, we've already covered that, right? That the bonding is just in the process of arousal. See, men need to understand that women sexually think very differently, just as women need to understand men think it and feel it very differently. The man is very easily... Here are huge sweeping generalisations, right? Which are accurate and true, but they're big sweeping generalisations. Enormous differences between individual people. But, basically, men are aroused very quickly, very simply, most commonly by eyesight, by what they see, and very superficially. A man can be turned on in a moment and turned off just as quickly. That's very simple and stuff. A woman is not aroused as quickly, especially sexually inexperienced girl is not aroused as quickly, is much more aroused by context, by relationship, by physical contact, is aroused much more slowly, but much more deeply and profoundly. So when she is aroused, it is not simple that she can just turn it off. Can't just go for a run around the oval and have forgotten about it. Whereas a fellow doesn't even have to get around the oval. Just to run to the oval will be enough. And so when he says to her, you see, but I can't help it, she believes it because she knows that once she's as aroused as that, she can't. But what she doesn't realise is he can help it. He can turn it off at any tick of the clock he wants to. All he has to do is walk outside and back in and it's all over and done with. It's as simple as that, but the girl doesn't know that. She thinks that he's aroused as profoundly as she is. Men's sexuality is superficial, like most things with men. Huh? Women's sexuality is very, very profound and deep, and long-lasting. And that is why the old courtly habits were so important, you see, that the man didn't start arousing the girl. Because it does become increasingly difficult for her to say no. When it doesn't become any more difficult for the fellow from the first moment to that moment. The control mechanisms, you see, very important for the girls to say no at the beginning, perfectly clearly, because you don't know what's down the track, girls. It's much greater than you ever imagined if you haven't been into it. As I hope most of you haven't, but if you haven't, it's much greater than you ever imagined. You don't understand how powerful the passions can be within inside your own body. They're designed to be. It's wonderful that they are. But they are enormous. Now, it's important, you see, that the bonding process doesn't start just when you have intercourse. Because intercourse doesn't start when you have intercourse. Intercourse starts with the whole process of foreplay. The whole process of setting the romantic context where the girl can feel just a feeling of security and warmth and being loved and being wanted and appreciated and valued, none of which you would think is particularly sexual. But of course it is all part of the sexual process of arousing. Now husbands, those of you who are married, it's very important that you provide that for your wives. Being men, you think, oh well, we'll have sex tonight, bang, we'll just do off you start. It's as simple as that. But girls actually want and need that sense of assurance and security. They need to be loved and romanced into the context where they feel comfortable and relaxed and happy and open. They need that foreplay. And it's a very important process to be developing within the relationship. But once you're developing that, you are doing the bonding process. There's a difficulty, isn't it? So in our dating, in our relating, we've got to be careful. I mean, certainly I want the fellows to be nice. I want them to pay attention to the girls. I want them to provide for them with the niceties of life, like the bunch of flowers and the rest. Certainly that's all very nice, but you've got to remember that as you press down that direction, down that track, you are starting a particular game, which has an end point in terms of intercourse. And just going down that game has already started to produce the bonding effect. And so you've got to be very careful what it is that you're doing. I think most Christians are just ignorant of the game they're playing. They're doing it by instinct. They're doing it because that's what everybody else does. That's how you go about doing it. You learn it from the culture, and they don't come to our conferences. What is sex, and when does bonding start? I think it's much the same question, this one. What I mean is, does bonding just occur with sexual intercourse, etc.? It's much the same question. There is a second one, though. If you think it is not sinful for a single person to masturbate by himself, is it not sinful for an unmarried couple to masturbate each other? P.S. I think it is sinful because it may involve bonding, even though it is not strictly sex. That's right. It is. It will have that effect. Right? Any of those physical contacts, whatever they don't have to go as far as masturbating, just the kissing and cuddling and necking and petting each other, all has a profound effect. And it's an extraordinary explosive effect upon the girls. And that dreadful feeling afterwards when they're let down and the hurt and hostility is quite great. Yeah, well, we'll come to masturbation in a little while, I'm sure, with other questions. Does it matter whether if we choose a partner whom we find good company and who is also godly, instead of another person who is godly, but we don't enjoy their company? It's a very good question. You see, I emphasise the fact that the choice should be made on the basis of godliness. That's right. But what happens if the person is just unattractive to you? Do you have to marry them just because they're godly? Well, we may laugh at that, but I'm so glad somebody has put this question in, because I've found a couple of people who have been tempted to. Right? And the answer is, of course not. You don't want to marry somebody, don't marry them. You don't like somebody, you don't like them. That's life. Not everybody clicks with everybody. Those kinds of personality differences. So don't, just because they're godly. However, if you're on a desert island and you want to be married, got to learn to change your taste. Haven't you? Well, sometimes, you see, I've had people, you know, in their 30s coming complaining to me about the fact there's nobody in the church to marry, and the fellow comes and complains to me one day, and the girl comes and complains another day, and I say, well, why don't they get together? And of course they don't like each other. And I say, well, if you're going to be choosy, well, don't complain. You know, there's the real choice, isn't it? And so you don't want to push it too far, but yeah, don't go down the track just because they're godly, you've got to marry them. In church or any little Bible study group, we do encourage one another, and I really care for them. To the opposite sex, they somehow get the wrong impressions. How do you actually tackle this problem? Yes. We're in big problems. Now, you are in big problems. I'm not. You are in big problems. And this will answer then several of the other questions that come out. When you're 13, 14, 15, you can take out one person and drop another person and take out another person and learn how to relate to people. And no great hassle, because at 13, 14, your heart can be broken and mended many times. Because at 13 and 14, most people are not actually thinking that they're playing a game called marriage. Most of them think they're playing a game called taking out a boyfriend or a girlfriend, going dating or something like that. When you get around 18, 19, 20, you can't play that taking out boys and girls game any longer, because you are in marriage country. Once you start taking out, the implications are very heavy. The average age of Australians are marrying in 19 for girls, 20 for boys. Hands up all those who are under 19. Yeah? There we go. Hands up those who are... Yeah, well, there you go. You see the problem? You are in marriage territory. You may not like being there, but you can't help it. That just happens as you get older. And so you can't just be taking people out without it having any implications for the possibility of marriage. Having said that, you then go into retirement. You say, well, I don't know if I want to marry them, so I won't take anybody out anymore. Well, here is the quickest way I know to remain single. And so you say, well, we won't play the dating game. What we'll play is just caring for people, trying to make up our mind. We're in a little prayer and Bible group with each other, and we just kind of get to like each other. And so one time over supper, I give her a cup of tea and say, will you marry me? And she'll say yes or no, and then we'll be able to announce it to the world, you know? And so, therefore, every time anybody is kind to anybody at a prayer and Bible group, they say, I wonder if this is the time the question comes. Now, you are in difficulty in this area. I'm not. So the next question, no answer to it. There is no answer, isn't it? I guess it just means we've got to be really kind to each other and thoughtful and sensitive, haven't we? Not to give the wrong impression, but not to make the stakes so high that people can't open up their batting innings. So that as soon as anybody shows any intention at all, you start measuring your finger. Yeah? Or everybody else starts saying, I wonder if... Yeah? We've just got to allow people some degree of latitude to be able to start being talking and finding friendship and initiating relationship without putting too much pressure that it must inevitably therefore lead to marriage. But at the same time, if we're not interested in even the possibility of marriage, we mustn't start initiating those kinds of relationships around the congregation, because the other person most likely will be. and therefore we must understand what's happening. So if you're sworn off marriage, then swear off members of the opposite sex for a decade or two, because you'll confuse them terribly. I'm so glad I'm married sometimes. Given that we know that godliness is the most important feature in a partner, how do we overcome or deal with the fact that we aren't attracted to people who are attractive by other standards like looks, height, common interests, etc.? Well, those other things are all right, just provided you recognise what they are. Basic trivia. In their right perspective, trivia is a very useful thing, isn't it? But you've just got to keep it as trivia. I'm interested that over a period of about 3 years in our church, the average age of the bridegrooms was younger than the age of the brides. It's the exact reverse of the national average. Fascinating, isn't it? Now, it can be lots of reasons. Christian fellows are slow. Christian women are fast. Hard to work out which is that as a likelihood. Can't be the Christians just got different values, you see. But being 1 or 2 years older, it doesn't really matter that much to us. That other things are more important features. I hope that's the case. But there'll be certain things that, you know, will be turn-offs for you, as they say in Matchmaker. And there's nothing wrong with those things being turn-offs for you. But just don't complain if there's no one around who suits you. Should a person have intention to get married before he or she goes into the boyfriend or girlfriend relationship? The point I'm just making, at your age, yes. Anything else is dishonest. You are too old to have exclusive relationships if you haven't got the possibility of marriage in mind. But having said that, you see the immediate problem, don't you? Does this mean, therefore, because we've been out twice, I've got to now propose? And we've got to keep saying to each other, no, it doesn't. You've got to have the opportunity of exploring the possibility of relationship, not being overcommitted just because of the character. We did have one fellow in our church some years ago who kept proposing to girls at supper. I think I found it very hard, I understand, to cope with. He never proposed to me, so I don't know. How do you know the one you choose is the one chosen by God for you? Well, you will know it the day after. God's will for you is that you remain married. Therefore, the one whom you've married is the one he wants you to stay with. Therefore, you will know exactly who that is the day after. You will never know beforehand. Can't know beforehand. But you don't need to know beforehand. All you need to know beforehand is to be godly. Afterwards, you do need to know, because you may be tempted to say, oh, I made a mistake. If I had married Drusilla, everything would now be apples. And that's always wrong. It's always wrong, that. You must never go in with the regrets view of marriage. But beforehand, no, you can't know if this is the one God has in mind for you, because he, she may have a heart attack in the church building just before you marry him. Yeah. One look of you coming down the aisle, plunk, down he goes. You don't know, you see. Clearly, if that happens, that was not the one. What role should emotions play when it comes to selecting a marriage partner? What about just using a checklist approach where a person has to match a certain criteria? Compatibility scores. Well, compatibility is almost a complete irrelevance to marriage, because the person you're compatible with when you're 20 may be very different to the person you're compatible with when you're 40. And when you marry somebody, you marry them for when they're 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70. So the essence is not finding the person with whom you're compatible when you're 20. The essence is finding the person to whom you are committed and who is committed to you, to make sure that we grow in compatibility through the next 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So compatibility is not the essence of it. What part should emotions play? Well, no part. What part do emotions play? quite a significant part. Don't want to command emotions about marriage. The Bible doesn't, I don't think I want to either. And so you can't say you must feel anything, necessarily. Right? There's nothing in the Bible against arranged marriages. Nothing. I'm not particularly for them, but there's nothing unbiblical about them. So you see, the emotional content is not the key. Certainly is not the key in terms of choosing a partner. Emotions get stirred by so many irrelevant factors, especially, of course, sexual arousal. That's one of the worst ones. However, if you can enter into intermarriage relationship without being at the slightest bit anxious, excited, then you're a very kind of unemotional person. Pretty hard to relate to you, frankly. And if you're asking, does this mean I should marry them even though I don't like them? I say, well, can't you find somebody you like? I mean, just because they're godly doesn't mean you have to marry them. I'd hope that you like them as well, and that you want to marry them. That would seem to me to be basic. What about using a checklist? Yeah, well, there's nothing wrong with that. It's a good idea. Why would it be wrong? I mean, when I come to buying a house, buying a car, buying a cow, I have a checklist. I know the kinds of things I'm looking for and the kinds of things I don't want. I had a checklist when I got married. I wanted God to provide for me a wife who would tell the truth. That was my checklist. It wasn't a bad one. It wasn't a good one. It wasn't full enough, sorry to say. But to be honest, that's the one that I had when I was an undergraduate and I was looking for a wife. I met my wife when I was in second year university, which was by age in first year today, of course, because I did the leaving certificate. So at your age, you see, I met my wife. Never really thought God would provide one quite as quickly who could speak the truth. Now, as with most prayers, after you get it answered in the positive, you kind of regret it. You ever live with someone who always told you the truth? You've got to be careful about your checklist, that you actually make it the way you want it, you see? It's a very painful process. However, it's been good for me. That's why God did that for me. It's been very good for me. But I think, you see, it's very sensible to actually think out what it is I want in a partner, in a husband, in a wife. What am I looking for? Because without thinking it out, you tend not to look. Or you tend to get caught up by irrelevancies. Now, I think there are things to look for. Godliness is the chief one. Things to look for in a husband, you see, that he is a loving man. Ponder it for a moment, girls, you see. The good husband is to love his wife as Christ loved the church. Therefore, the person to look for in a good husband is a bloke who is loving, like Christ. Now, how did Christ love? Well, he laid down his life for his enemies. Not for his friends, but for his enemies. He laid down his life for people who are unlovable and unlovely. And so you go into a group, you see, and you see somebody who is always being thoughtful of the weak person, of the new person, of the stranger, of the wallflower. You see, the person is always being kind and tender and putting themselves out for the sake of other people who are in great need, who may not be very lovely or lovable particularly, who may actually not even like him, but who is concerned for them and their well-being, actively. And you find a man like that, he will make a wonderful husband. You say, well, I don't like him. Well, he'll make somebody else a wonderful husband. But he'll make a wonderful husband. Because if he does that for people who are unlovely, there's every chance he'll be kind to you too. Is that right? However you may be. Because what you want is a man who will love you over the breakfast table when you're 70. You don't just want to love someone who will love you when you're walking down the aisle having spent 3 hours at the beauty parlour and $100 on a dress that you'll never wear again. I mean, a man who will love you at that kind of moment, well, he's a nothing. Any twit can do that. It's a question of whether he'll love you when you're 70 over the breakfast table. That's what you need, you see, the love that'll last. And so the question in the marriage service is, will you? And the answer is, I will, or I won't, depending on how you feel. But The question that Hollywood always asks is, do you? And the answer they give is, I do. That is, I do love her. That's an irrelevance whether you do love her. The question is, will you love her? For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, I am going on to love her. Very, very different to, boy, of course I love her. Look at her. Who wouldn't love her today? I don't know about tomorrow, the day after. You know, when she gets a bit old and saggy and baggy, well, that's a different kettle of fish then. And you see, what kind of person do you look for? You look for the man who is loving, kind, gentle. The fact that he's tall, rich, dark, handsome, none of those things will actually matter to the marriage in the long run. The fact whether he's rich or poor, the fact that he's healthy, the fact that they actually don't make any better marriage partners. One of the worst marriage partners, girls, is that very able, fascinating, lively, life of the party, competitive, successful, aggressive male. He, by and large, is a pig of a husband. His very egocentricity prevents him from caring for you. His very success will blow his head up to such an extent that he'll never care for somebody in their weakness. You'll always have to compete to gain his attention and his affection. Yeah, pig of a husband. But he may be the one who's most attractive to you on the world standard, you see. Now, fellows, what do you need? In a wife, a gentle and quiet spirit. In God's sight, very precious, you're told. It's an imperishable jewel, 1 Peter chapter 3. Because the wife is to submit to her husband. And therefore, which wife is the one that you'll be able to live with? The one who is nagging, pushy, bossy, aggressive, competitive, or the one who is gentle and quiet? Obviously, there's no difficulty, there's no comparison, is there? The physically beautiful? No, don't marry the physically beautiful. It's ridiculous. Spend the rest of your life and most of your paycheck trying to keep her that way. Lost cause. I had a lovely bloke who used to live across the road from me, and when he married some years before I did, and I used to go babysitting his kids, and he said to me, Philip, when you marry, make sure she's got no teeth and no hair and lost her appendix. He said, from there on in, it's cheap. He was an engineer, I confess, he was. Very nice fella. Funny looking wife. See, the physical beauty fades like the fade. You'll never be more beautiful than you are at the moment. It's a downhill slide from here on in. Have the gentle and quiet spirit is something that can make a woman more and more beautiful as she gets older. More and more attractive. So what do you look for in a wife, you see? So there's a checklist, isn't it? Mind you, it's a wrong approach to marriage. The right approach is to make a checklist about yourself. You keep thinking, if I get the right partner, then I will be happy. Bully for you. That's the kind of person not to marry. Someone who wants to see marriage in terms of what's going to make my life satisfying. Fellows, certainly understand what makes for a beautiful wife, gentle and quiet spirit, but work at being loving husbands, because you, loving husbands, are the kinds of people who will make beautiful wives. And girls, certainly by all means, look for the loving, kind, gentle husband, but work at having a gentle and quiet spirit, for the gentle and quiet spirit will bring that tenderness and kindness and self-sacrifice out of a husband. So work on your own side of the coin. Now, what was the question I was asked? If one is not seriously interested in marriage but does not want to actively dissuade a potential marriage partner, what attitude should one take towards the opposite sex? Now, I think if you're not seriously interested in marriage, then you should dissuade potential marriage partners. Because the other person has got enough problems already without being held in limbo as to whether you are or aren't interested. It's just not being kind to them. If you're a person who's decided for life or for the moment that you're not going to get married, then I think you need to run the flag up pretty clearly for anybody else who's interested in you. Because I just think there are too many broken hearts around the countryside, and you'll be creating more. Make up your mind which it is going to be. How can one tell if they have the gift of remaining single? Is it a good thing to remain single if you can? Well, the passage that Paul has is that the alternative is to be aflame with passion. If you don't find yourself in strong sexual stimulation and concern and dreaming about it and thinking about it, constantly noticing it, when you don't find yourself in strong, then go down to the doctor and have a checkout. If after you've had a good checkup, taking your vitamin tablets, running around the block each morning, eating your Vitabrits and all the rest of it, you still don't find it, well then maybe you have the gift. And that's what it's about. You either have strong sexual instincts or you don't. Some people don't. There's absolutely nothing wrong with not having them if you don't have them, because that's God's gift for you, so that you'll get on with the work of the Lord. Perfectly all right. All right? But if you have sexual appetite at all, then I suspect you don't have the gift of remaining single. If the person wants to come and talk to me about it, I'm happy for them to talk to me about it privately, so as to talk about what it's like with them. How does the Bible use the word adultery, sexual immorality? Is adultery only referring to extramarital relations, or does it also include premarital relationships? Does sexual immorality refer to sexual intercourse, or is it more general? Please clarify. Yes, certainly. Adultery means sex where one person is married to somebody else. So adultery's always got to do with somebody being married. The word for sexual intercourse outside of marriage is the word fornication. Unfortunately, the word fornication is not understood in modern English, and so the modern translators have now used the word sexual immorality to translate it. It's also because the word that was translated fornication had a slightly wider meaning than just fornication. It also included any form of sex outside of marriage, homosexuality as well. And so the modern translators are not wrong in having a sexual immorality, but it just means you now can't find any verse anywhere in the Bible which says that sex outside of marriage, where neither partner is married, is included. But the word in the Greek, porneia, actually does mean fornication. And the old translation was right in using that translation. And you just have to translate it into modern English. Why is it that the Christian fellows, especially in our church, seem much less interested in going out with Christian girls than the average non-Christian? Is it just pride? Well, I haven't done full research on this to know whether what you're saying is true, but I can give you some reasons if it is true. One, non-Christian fellows don't care whom they hurt to the same extent that Christians care about whom they hurt. See, for a non-Christian to take somebody out and then drop them, chalk it up to experience. For a Christian, I just can't chalk up another person to experience. I can't chalk up a Christian sister to experience. And that makes Christians just a little bit slower on it. Secondly, Christian fellows are, unlike non-Christian fellows, concerned about their own sexual holiness, and therefore a little slower in the whole dating business and practice. A non-Christian fellow is fairly keen to have it off with a girl as quickly as he can. And so therefore, he gets out into the race as early as he can to see how far he can go in any kind of context. Now, not all non-Christian men are pigs like that, but the whole general ethos of the male talking is like that. And so they encourage, whereas the Christian fellow does not want to do that and is less certain and less experienced in the whole dating game and practice and more concerned not to hurt the girl's feelings. And so I think there is a truth in it that they tend to be a little bit slower, later in maturing and developing in this area of life, and I think it's because they're a little bit more loving and kind. And the girls, who get a little frustrated by the fact that the non-Christians keep asking him out and the Christians don't, need to remember that it's because their brothers are to some extent loving them, rather than that they are dimwits who can't see the pearls that lie before them. However, fellows, get a move on. Yes, Stephen. I don't think it is. I don't think it is. But it just has to do with leadership. But there is something instinctive in leadership. It's got to do with the male now, whether it's socialised or instinct, I'm not going to enter into. But the point is that the men take leadership, partly out of a sexual thing too. In sex itself, men tend to take the leadership. Men want the women to initiate in sexual encounters within marriage, but by and large the male will, because the male is more quickly and easily stimulated. Thinks about it more often. I think the average girl would be horrified to understand how much the average fellow thinks about sex. Or how little he thinks about anything else. You did hear, girls, how deep the laugh was then, didn't you? So, not a specific question, but an emphasis, the comment that's made here, and I think it's a good one. What about when sex doesn't live up to your expectations on the honeymoon or in marriage? About the realities of relative frequency of finding sex hard work and difficult and frustrating. That's right. So far, what I've done is spoken in terms of the positive attitude to sex, and that's because I am in vast reaction to the misinterpretation of Christianity that you have been fed, which has said sex is wonderful and marvellous, adultery, immorality, everything is marvellous, except for Christians who are all for repression, who think it's nasty, mean, horrible, wretched stuff that you've got to stop and not enjoy. And you see, that's a total misrepresentation. The pagan view of sex is an abuse and use of other people for your own self-gratification. It's a dreadful nonsense. And the Christian view of sex, rather than being repressive, is very pro-pleasure and enjoyment, in finding the fulfilment of your sexual expression, in procreation, and in bonding friendship, fellowship with your partner for life, in loving and serving each other. And so in my reaction against that false view, you say, I've pushed that, but then what happens if sex doesn't work in marriage? What happens if, is it always wonderful? Are honeymoons marvellous? Now let me tell you something, unless you get married by St. Matthias and Nathaniel Park University Church through marrying Sam Howell, I can't say Sam, marrying because his son's Sam, marrying Derek. The man who does the marriage, so you don't all have to marry him. Although he has married hundreds of beautiful women. In fact, I've married quite a few too. But unless you get married by us, you stand a very good chance of not enjoying your honeymoon. It's extraordinary, isn't it? That's unbelievable. Of course you'll enjoy your honeymoon. Well, most people who live a celibate life prior to marriage don't enjoy their honeymoon. That's one of the fascinations of life, isn't it? It's got to do with totally unrealistic sexual expectations. Totally unrealistic. Now, we try in our briefing sessions before marriage to warn people that the first sexual encounter and intercourse for a girl is sometimes, to a small extent, painful, and rarely ever the great moment of bliss and excitement that you would imagine from having seen movies that you shouldn't have seen. It just isn't like that very often, the breaking of the hymen is enough to cause some small pain and blood, but most people even don't discuss it, most fellows don't know it exists, most girls don't know it exists. But there is part of the deal, you see, which people don't talk about, no one prepares you for, you go away in the marriage and very difficult. Friends of mine went in the marriage and they actually found intercourse impossible, went in the honeymoon. Now, fortunately, people had told them of the possibility that it mightn't happen. And just the hymen there was he couldn't penetrate that. And so, in fact, for the whole 2 weeks, they were not able to have intercourse at all. Can you imagine the emotional, psychological frustration, anguish, horror at this point? Here we've got married. Here we're finally, after waiting months and months and months, and we don't seem to be able to do it. There's something wrong with us. There's something wrong with you. Would both feel. Fortunately, they had been talked to beforehand and were able to go, even on the honeymoon site, they went to a doctor to investigate what the problems were and were able to have a small operation and fix it up afterwards. It's a 1 in 1,000, or I don't know what the statistics on that kind of thing, but doctors amongst us, is it? Who would know the statistics on something like that? Who is that kind of medical practitioner? Come on. I mean, yeah, no, it would be fairly rare, wouldn't it? I've spoken to hundreds and hundreds of couples after marriage, and that's the only person I've ever known. So don't think, oh, it's going to be a disaster in that proportion. But, you see, unrealistic expectations can cause a big trouble at this point, can't they? Some people do have initial and some continuing sexual frustrations and difficulties within marriage. Most people have one very common one. That is, the man wants to have sex far more often than the woman does. That is a fairly normal one. And that is a very healthy one. It's a good one because it teaches both of them to learn how to serve their partner, to adjust their own needs and desires to the needs and desires of their partner and stop using sex for self-centeredness. To actually be concerned for how my partner feels about it rather than just how I feel about it. It's very important growth in godliness, that one. But most people have that kind of difficulty. Some people, of course, have even greater difficulty as they find, for various reasons, orgasm difficult, premature ejaculations, there's a whole range of fairly common problems. Now, one of the good things that comes out of a more permissive society is that people have studied more freely and intelligently sexual responsiveness so that many of those kinds of sexual, what do I call them, malfunctions, can be considerably helped today. And that's a great thing and a great help. But you do need to recognise that the kinds of nonsense that you see in movies is nonsense. It's always easy. It's always simple. It's like there's a whole variety of things. Have you ever noticed in the movies that you see people drinking nearly all the time? Do you hardly ever see them go to the toilet? Ever notice that? It's a fascinating thing about the kind of constitution that American Hollywood actors and actresses have. Now, they're different to the rest of us. They just can drink all the time. Now, you're sorry I mentioned that, aren't you? Well, likewise, you see, some of the awkwardnesses about contraceptives never come up in the Hollywood romantic. Some of the awkwardnesses about people's sexual feelings actually don't come up. Some of the difficulties that people have in their sexual expression don't come up. It's always just immediately one kiss, cloud nine. And that's not what it's necessarily like. So here I'm trying to emphasise to you the goodness of it all and the rightness to have it and the need to express it properly. But this comment's a very helpful one, just to remind you that there is another aspect of it that's not really being covered and pushed here. That is, that inside the marriage itself, you may have difficulties, and you mustn't expect that it's all just going to be, incredible. Sometimes it can be very, very personally, agonisingly difficult. But there's good help that you can receive, so if you do find it difficult, go and ask for help early on from a professional. What is the role of masturbation, and what context should it be placed in, should we place it in? Well, the Bible condemns every form of sexual immorality that you can think of, explicitly. You know, bestiality and homosexuality and lesbianism and all kinds of detailed condemnations. And yet it never mentions masturbation. Yet we know that it was well known in the ancient world. So, what do you draw from that? Well, I take it if the Bible is silent, then it's not against it. Well, could it possibly be a right thing? Well, why wouldn't it be a right thing? Well, you say, because the aim of sex is procreation and masturbation doesn't do that. And the aim of sex is building fellowship and masturbation doesn't do that. So it doesn't seem to fulfil the aims of sexuality. And I think that's right, and that's why, in the end, that is not an ultimate solution. If you have strong sex drive, the solution is marriage. But what do you do in the times in which you cannot marry? Or you cannot have sex with your partner? What do you do then? So when would that be? Your partner's sick. See, I know a man who married, and his wife shortly thereafter had a complete mental breakdown, and she was, till she died 40 years later, was never out of a psychiatric hospital. Very dreadful story, isn't it? I mean, dreadful story, very rare thing. But he made his promises to that woman, and it is greatly to his credit that he stuck with his promises, didn't marry anybody else, faithfully visited her, provided for her, financed her. For better, for worse, that was the worst. What do you do with your sexuality in that context? You're aflame with passion, but you do not have the possibility of sexual satisfaction. There's a good illustration of the kinds of problems. What do you do if you cannot find a partner now? If for socioeconomic reasons you're not able to marry? What do you do if your wife is sick? What to do if your wife's sexual response is going into difficulty so that you cannot have sex with her now without giving her further difficulties in your marriage? What do you do if your husband is having those kinds of problems or is away at war? I mean, there's any number of situations, you see, in which people with normal sexual drives are confronted with a pressure that Paul says is intolerable. Now, mankind has discovered for centuries and knows only too well that one thing to do is to masturbate. You don't get many talks on this subject, and that is a great shame. Well, it's not really. I mean, who wants to spend their life talking about this subject? But it is a shame that no one ever talks about it, because it's so clothed in secrecy and privacy that most people automatically feel guilty about it. Anything that has to be done that privately and secretly must be naughty, mustn't it? And indeed, there are those many people who have argued that it is wrong. And of course those other questions, yes, on the back of this one, I remember. And does it really make you go blind? You see, there is that kind of sinister put down and more dreadful warnings to people. And there's also the whole process of little children growing up and playing with their genitals in public and the parents saying, dear, don't do that. You mustn't play with yourself. And so you've got this instinct built into you from being a little kid that to play with yourself is automatically wrong, bad thing. So there's a whole range of reasons why we feel deep guilt and shame about the subject of masturbation, about the practice of masturbation. But yet, it does provide for people a way of sexual release without involving them in fornication, a way which is never condemned in Scripture, and so therefore I've got no grounds upon which to condemn it, a way which does solve the need for people. Is it an alternative to marriage? No, except where necessary. Does that make sense? If you say, well, I'm not going to get married, I'll just masturbate. No, that's not what the Bible's saying. I can't go that line. But if you're caught in the context where you can't marry or your marriage cannot provide for your sexual needs, then masturbation may be a way of coping with that. Now, some people don't like it. That's, you know, perfectly all right. Don't do it. Some people do like it and do find it helps them. Well, I say, if that's the case, then do it. The other big problem it comes to is what happens to the fantasies at the time. Now, the essence of it's got to do with self-control. That's what you're being taught, to be in self-control. If you've ever done it, you'll notice that immediately afterwards you feel as if you didn't need to do it. One of the characteristics of it, but then that's the characteristic of sex. Once the release has taken place, there is a tremendous relaxation that makes you feel, you wonder what on earth was the great thing that had you wound up 5 minutes ago. That is the character of an orgasm. It's the character, therefore, of a masturbatory orgasm. So you say, well, what do I do with my mindset? Now, it seems to me quite unhealthy to think of nothing while masturbating. Because what that says is that it is a purely functional activity, like eating or going to the toilet, which sex isn't. It seems to me also to use your mind to think of immorality, to dream, to fantasize of that which is perverted or that which is illegal, immoral or ungodly. So does that mean now that I cannot think of anything? I don't know. I'm saying, you see, if you train yourself to think, to imagine, to fantasize sexual immorality at the time at which you're having an orgasm, then what are you training yourself to think about in the future with your wife or husband? So you're actually teaching yourself that the way of mental titillation is immorality. That's a bad thing. What you've got to do is actually try and imagine to fantasize in terms of that which is sexually normal and moral. So imagine yourself in terms of marriage. That seems to be the way forward. So it's lusting after your neighbour's wife that Jesus is against. It's not dreaming of the possibility of the hope of the future of your own married life, which is a perfectly acceptable way of teaching yourself to think positively about sex, enjoyable in a moral relationship. Now, most of us are sitting here with a stunned mullet expression. As James Dobson says in his films, at this point, I can hear the bloke in the back row breathing. It's that kind of subject, isn't it? Some of us are sitting with stunned mullets because we actually don't know what masturbation is. But everybody else in the room obviously does, so we won't open our mouths at this time because we don't want to show ourselves more ignorant than we are. Fear not. Rejoice and be glad. You don't need to know. There are some of us, it just means stimulating yourself, having an orgasm by stimulating yourself through stimulating your own genitals, that's all. Lots of people do, lots of people don't. It's hard to know the statistics, but it seems as if most men do, it seems as if many women do, but most women most likely don't. But it's very hard to get women to talk honestly and candidly about it. So there's the statistics that given via Kinsey's report is, of course, that 97% of American males say they masturbate and the other 3% are liars. That was the result that came. But I'm not sure that that's true. However, there is a pattern. It's a very common experience amongst men at some points in their lives. For some, it's all their lives. That's the character. Now, some of us are sitting here stunned and quiet about it because it has been a long-term battle. Of course, the more guilty you are about it, the more filled with shame, the more you battle against it, the more you are trying to stop a starving man from eating. It just gets worse and worse and worse until you fall, as they say, into the dreaded grip of masturbation so that you cannot stop, you know, and it really becomes obsessive. But the obsession comes out of the prohibition rather than out of the activity. If you see it as a normal, healthy way of finding release during those times of pressure because of lack of marriage relationship and opportunity, then that's all it needs to be used for and can easily fall under your control. If you find that you can only masturbate by thinking of immoral, illegal, kinky, twisted, perverted sexuality, then frankly you don't need to masturbate at that time. There's not much sexual pressure that needs to release. And to continue doing that, you'll find unhelpful. Well, is anyone brave enough to want to ask a question about the subject? I can cope with it if you can. couple of brave men in the back. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I think many do find it confusing how they relate to females and how they relate to their own sexuality. Partly because no one will talk about it like we are doing at this moment. No one will say it's good or bad. There's just the snigger behind the hand from the messages from our schoolboy backgrounds, etc. And because the fantasy level we allow to take over us. So we watch a dirty movie on television, then go and masturbate with all those weirdo views in our heads, and then feel all confused about sexuality, rather than being in control of what it is we're thinking about and why we're doing it. Making it as a purposeful intention of our life to cope with our present sexual needs in this way, rather than being caught up with it hopelessly. Yes, I think fantasies about specific girls, really you'll find unhelpful. Much better keep it just vague and general about the female shape. If you really have got a sexual drive and a build-up, you really don't need almost any fantasy to be able to masturbate. Now you are hearing me say, this is a matter of liberty and freedom, aren't you? You're not now feeling under pressure that there's something wrong with you because you don't masturbate, are you? Okay. I mean, if you don't, you don't. And if you do, you do. The basic thing I'm saying is, don't worry. And boy, if you can just be free to the worry, the anxiety, the obsession about the thing, 99% of the problem goes. Because that's where the problem is. It's not in the act. It's in the mindset around it. In Genesis 2:18, God says, it's not good for a man to be alone. Does this mean that they, being single, is inferior to being married? Inferior is the loaded word, isn't it? No, it's superior in gospel preaching of an itinerant kind. But yes, we don't work well singly. Somebody asks another question about the need for men to marry, and it's massive. Men are very fragile. They are very superficial. They are very weak. They do not cope well with being single. They cope very badly with being single. The widowers die. Widows live on. Not forever, but, you know. Men cannot cope without their wives. Wives seem to be able to cope better without their men. And it's a funny thing, you know, that for all their kids, you know, Bravo and the rest of it, men are actually the fragile ones. In fact, that's why they've got to roar so loud. You worked out what to do yet? How is it that fathers... How is the fathers, brothers, uncles would even want to sexually assault the daughter, niece or sister? Where does this desire, where does the desire to sin in this way come from? And a dear friend who asked the question, I'm glad it's anonymous, because then, you know, it's not a personal insult that I give to you now, but you've got to look closer into your heart. I'm going to say you've got to grow up. If you think that sinning like that is beyond you, you don't know yourself yet. Sin is desperately deep in our systems. And the basic reason we don't sin more is lack of provocation, lack of opportunity. But given the opportunity and the provocation, there is nothing that I am incapable of. It's taken me a long time to learn it, but the Bible says it's true, and that my experience is so too. The basic reason I don't do more evil, rotten, wretched things is just lack of opportunity. And if you think this is unthinkable, you haven't lived yet. Sorry to be so cruel. Could you explain how what the Bible says about adultery applies to people who are not married? Yeah, we've already said that, fornication. For a person guilty of sexual sin after becoming a Christian, what are some of the issues that need to be worked through, and what should be the attitude of a future Christian partner to the knowledge that the person sins? Are there any issues or things that someone considering married a person guilty of previous sexual sin, despite being a Christian having repented of it, should think about or be concerned, warned of? Yep. You see, I know a Christian who has a terrible problem with exaggerating the truth. And although they've been converted for some years, it's taking them years to learn to tell the truth accurately, rather than constantly be exaggerating. I know a person who's converted and who's an infomaniac. And although they've been converted, it's taken them years to learn sexual abstinence and purity. Now, which of those two is less Christian? No, that's wrong. You see, we tend to make sexual sins worse than other sins. One of them has, of course, bigger repercussions. The poor person who's, the poor girl who's an infomaniac, has terribly big repercussions. Got all these one-night stand men around the city that she can't bear to look at or think about. And we've got terrible repercussions about her own self-esteem and a whole range of problems that have come out of it. But she's no more sinful than the person who's having trouble with their tongue, is she? In fact, in some ways, she needs more sympathy and help, encouragement. One of the great miracles of grace is that particular person has been cured of that problem. It's a marvellous thing. It's a great victory of the gospel of Jesus Christ in people's lives, just as the person who can be exaggerating can be cured of that. And we mustn't make the distinction as worse. But what do you do then about marrying such a person? Well, the only person who would marry such a person is someone who understands the gospel and who knows that forgiveness is based on the death of Jesus and not on performance. Now, if you've sinned in this area after you've converted, then ask God to forgive you. And know that through the death of Jesus Christ you are forgiven. And do not go on sinning in this area. If you continue to sin in this area, then come and seek out proper advice about it to try and work out what the problem is, why it is you continue to fail in this area. If you do fail in this area, though, it is one that you do need to confess to your partner before you accept their proposal in marriage or before you propose to them. I don't think you need to tell every person you ever take out. First night, will you come out? And by the way, here is what has happened to me in the last X years. I don't think that is the case. But before they enter into a contract, you do need to discuss it and make it clear. Sometimes that's very difficult. One of my friends went to talk to their partner about it and said, I'd like to marry you, but this is what has happened. To which the girl says, well, I would like to accept, but this is what has happened. Both of them were in shock for a week or so because it hadn't occurred to them that it would have happened with their partner. But both of them understood the gospel enough to realise that it was about being forgiven. Given that man and woman were created to live together, how is it possible for unmarried people to live fulfilled lives? Because in Christ we are married. The person who's written that one needs to get the tape of the campus Bible study talk to see how the marriage in heaven is our real marriage. Joe, don't take notice of who's been getting this talk in the next few weeks. There is a long letter. Let me go for the simple ones. Genesis 2 seems to describe the purpose of woman as being a mere appendage of man. Her mind for his fellowship, her body for his comfort, and to bear and raise his children. She does not seem to have any role as a spiritual leader or teacher. So what then about the world of economics, politics or intellectual endeavour? If I marry, I am suddenly subject to and called to submit to an ordinary sinful man. I think this is written by a woman, this one. So where does this leave a smart girl? Where is the God of justice? Yeah, I think you're right. It does seem to you to describe the purpose of woman like that. I think that's right. And I think what needs to be helped is a correction of your appreciation of what Genesis 2 is saying. That is, if you read Genesis 2 like that, then you will find difficulty in seeing the God of justice. She is created for fellowship. That is true. Her body for his comfort and his body for her comfort. Why do you only put it one way when the Bible is speaking both ways? If you screen out half the information, Yes, you can present it as a miserable deal. But if you take into account all the information, then it actually will create for you a wonderful deal. But you see, a lot of this is built on the wording. Right? It's built on the wording of picking on words like submit. I'm picking on no role as a spiritual leader or teacher. The Bible gives a very clear role to women to teach their children, to teach younger women. That does account for 75% of the population. That's what it accounts for. But we are now being encouraged to think negatively about the whole deal. And I want to warn the girls about it very seriously, because what you're being encouraged to think about on the basis of justice is actually antisocial. What is the alternative? It's not women's rights, it's the single person's rights that are being fought for. It's not women's rights, it's single person's rights that are being fought for. It's not an alternative of being a woman or being a person. It's the alternative of being a member of the family as opposed to being a single person. That's what it's about. Family life will not work with competitive adults. It'll only work with submissive adults, with each partner serving the other. That's what you need to make the family work. But if you're going to set up the family with each of them having their rights, it's a disaster area. A girl came to see me. I'll change the story for the tape. Girl came to see me. She's a dentist. He's a lawyer. Both of those are wrong. She says, he wants to marry me. And I want to marry him. But I don't want to give up dentistry. I say, okay. It's your choice. She says, if I do dentistry, then I want to make sure that written into the very contract, into the agreement with him, not literally, but just in our understanding, that he understands that we both share 50-50 in this marriage. But, you know, 50-50 in terms of the finances, 50-50 in terms of the housework, 50-50 in terms of caring for the kids. You know, if I take a year off to look after the kid, he takes a year off to look after the kid. Everything is 50-50. One of the most stupid women I've ever met. She'll listen to this tape and laugh, because I actually think she's very clever. But at that point, she displayed her stupidity. Because the man she wanted to marry is one of the most godly Christian men that I know. She actually made a very, very wise choice in husbands. He's totally submissive in terms of laying down his life, loving like Christ, for the sake of his bride. If she had just so much as lifted her finger, he would have done everything she wanted. By insisting that he only did 50%, she was losing 50%. That's absolutely crazy. Marriages are not made out of 50% and 50%. Marriages are made out of 100% and 100%. And you say, but that's not mathematical. Well, that's the idea, you see. 1 + 1 = 1. It's not mathematical. Now, as long as people say, well, you know, I'm making my contribution, therefore I'm going to have my rights, please don't marry them. Anyone who wants to come in that circus, they're not fit to marry. They're a disaster area of marriage. That's not the game we're talking about. We're talking about how two people can actually merge into one person. That does not happen by people sticking up for their rights. It cannot happen. And what the women's argument on justice is about, on sticking up for your rights is about, is really their argument that women don't have to marry. And that's absolutely true. They don't have to marry. They can remain single if they wish to. The great terror is that with this kind of philosophy, they try marriage. That's the terror. Because this is a philosophy of singleness, not a philosophy of marriage. Notice that 1 Corinthians 7 passage again. That the woman, doesn't own her own body, but the husband owns it. Yeah, there's slavery for you, isn't it? Your body will be the possession of your husband's to use as he needs and sees fit. How's that for slavery? And the verse then goes on to say, and the husband's body doesn't belong to the husband. It belongs to the wife for her to use as she wants. So they're both slaves of each other. You see how it doesn't, you know, it's got nothing to do with rights. It's got nothing to do with sticking up for your part of the bargain or something like that. It's got to do with complete enslavement both ways. Well, we've had enough, haven't we? There's about three or four to go. We can pick those off in the morning. Isn't that a better idea?
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.